today in Daniel chapter 11, beginning with verse 21 and going through verse 35, we see a description of a man that Daniel's prophecy foretold would come. History confirms that he has. And he is among the Greek rulers, and he is the most evil and regarded as the most hated ruler and conqueror of Israel in her history. He, as we look back, provides us with an understanding of what the Antichrist will look like when he comes. And so he serves as a type of that, but this is not the end. This is a prelude of things to come. And so today we're going to look at the description that is given to a man named Antiochus Epiphanes. The word Epiphanes is one that he added of himself. He's actually Antiochus IV, but he called himself Epiphanes, which means God manifested. He believed himself to be a God. Now you say, well, he must have been a real crackpot. Well, he was. That's a good description. Not necessarily a technical psychological term, but nonetheless, it's as good as any of the others that have been given of him. The Jews of his day called him not Antiochus Epiphanes, but Antiochus Epimenes, and it means madman. And so they believed him to be a madman, and he certainly was. Now, why is this significant? Because he is the type of what we will see in the future. And so you say, well, so we know what to watch for when the Antichrist comes. Well, yeah, if we're here when that happens, then yes, you'll know what to watch for. Although, let me give you a more relevant and immediate application of our understanding of this historical figure. Everything that is made manifest in this evil ruler, embrace yourselves, okay? This may be a real hard pill to swallow. Everything manifested in this evil ruler is present in all of us. The deception and the lies and the sin and the evil, that's us. It's not what we want. It's not what we know we are called to. It's not who we are made to be. We are being redeemed out of that. But we must never forget that who we are is someone that Christ has made us to be, not someone that we have made ourselves to be. If left to ourselves, we are no different than this person. What's the point? The point is we are utterly and absolutely dependent on God's grace given to us in Jesus Christ. Prelude of things to come. First thing that we see in verse 21 is the rise of Antiochus. It says, in his place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Antiochus Epiphanes rose to power in 175 B.C., Seleucus IV, who was his brother, died. He had been the ruler of the northern kingdom spoken of in the previous verses of chapter 11. He was then succeeded by his younger brother. Now, in the succession of royalty, that's not how it goes. So if the brother, Seleucus, being the older brother, was the next in line for the throne, and then he got married and had a son, then if something happens to him, his brother doesn't take over, his son does. But his son had been given to Rome as a hostage. And Rome is holding him as hostage the way they did his brother also. Antiochus got released from his hostage situation by manipulating Roman authorities and promising them that if he could get away from Rome, he would go back and take over the throne of the northern kingdom and he would be loyal to Roman interest. And so he was a manipulative politician who used his wily ways in order to get his freedom, but also to seize the kingdom. So Seleucus IV dies. His son is in jail in Rome. Antiochus is released. He goes back to Syria, where he assumes the kingdom, and he takes over and is in control of the northern kingdom. This is the reason that it says, "To whom royal majesty has not been given. He shall come in without warning, and he will obtain the kingdom by flatteries." It's not a military conquest. He comes in with the support of Rome, and he comes in by promising the people the moon, literally. He's going to give them everything their hearts desire. He's going to make them happy. He's going to protect them. He's going to expand the kingdom. They're going to be wealthy. All of this is a promise being made. What does it sound like? It sounds like a campaign speech. That's what it sounds like. I'm just bracing for the impact that is coming soon. So he uses political intrigue and manipulation rather than military might in order to secure his place. He doesn't come at them in a full frontal assault. He comes at them as a slithering, slimy serpent. Familiar? Let me tell you, if you don't learn anything, learn this. If you don't remember anything, remember this. Satan's never going to come at you in a full frontal assault. He's not going to come at you with horns and a pitchfork and a pointy tail. He's not painted red, or he isn't red from the inside out and glowing. That's not how he's going to come. He's not going to come like a monster in the night. He's not going to come like some manifestation of your worst nightmare. He's going to come as a brilliant light of appeal. He is going to come at you in a way that is going to sound pretty good. He's going to say things like, you know, this is good. You deserve this. You worked hard. You really have earned it. It's okay. I know you've got some hesitations. But those are just archaic traditions that have been forced upon you by an oppressive past. And you need to set that aside. It'll liberate you, and you'll enjoy life. He's going to come at you promising you all of this fulfillment. He's going to come at you and say, you know, people don't understand you. You're unique. You're special. That word can be used in a lot of ways, you know. You're so smart and intelligent. You see things that other people don't. Just go ahead and enjoy this because somebody else doesn't agree, that doesn't mean you shouldn't do this. He's going to come at you in a way that says, you know, you've misunderstood what you've always thought to be true. And that's not really what it meant. And that's not really what it says. Let me help you understand it from a new perspective, and we'll stretch it out a little bit so that you can start to see that this isn't something that's meant to govern you. It's meant to make you happy. So if you're understanding in a way that feels like it's convicting you of something wrong, well, that's just not right. You shouldn't be paying attention to that. He's always going to come at you like a friend. He's always going to come at you as one who says he has your best interest at heart. He's going to be the one that says, look, I want to help you. I want to show you that I care for you by making you happy. He's going to be attractive. He's going to be relevant. He's going to be popular. And he's going to represent the majority. That's the way Satan comes at us. That is exactly the way Antiochus came to power. This is a method that is as old as time itself. And it is the very nature of evil. And what we are seeing in this evil ruler is nothing more than an old, tired story of lies that have been a part of everything that we have known. So in 175, after the death of Seleucus, Antiochus comes to power shortly thereafter. He doesn't really make a stink about it for a couple of years, but that's going to change. In verses 22 and 23, we see the beginning of the reign of Antiochus IV. So we've seen the rise, now the reign of Antiochus. It says in verse 22, "Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. And from the time that an alliance is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, and he shall become strong with a small people. Then without warning, he shall come into the richest part of the province, and he shall do what neither his fathers nor his father's fathers have done, scattering among them plunder, spoil, and goods. He shall devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time." In verse 25, it says, "He shall stir up his power and his heart against the king of the south." Now, I want you to look at verse 25 as going back to verse 22. So verses 22, 3, and 4 are a summary of what happens. Now, verse 25 gives additional detail of that as well. "So he shall stir up his power and his heart against the king of the south." Same thing if you look at verse 22. "Armies will be swept away before him and broken." Which ones? The south. "The king of the south will wage war with an exceedingly great army, but he shall not stand, for plots shall be devised against him. Even those who eat his food shall break him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. And as for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but to no avail, for the end is yet to be at the time appointed. And he shall return to his land with great wealth, but his heart shall be set against the holy covenant, and he shall work his will and return to his own land." So in the reign of Antiochus, we see that that he launches an attack. The attack is going to come against the south. So we're still talking about the kingdom of the north, Syria, and we're talking about the kingdom of the south, Egypt. We know all of this historically in great detail from records that have been kept down through the ages. And so we can look back at this and we can see this fulfillment of very specific prophecy. Antiochus launches an attack against the king of the south. That's what's described for us in verses 22 and 23. The king of the south is Ptolemy the VI. Ptolemy the VI wants to have control of Palestine, but so does the Syrian king. At the present time, the Syrians have it. "The armies will be swept away," it says in verse 22. In verse 25, "He will stir up his power and his heart against the king of the south with a great army." So all of this is descriptive of this big conflict that's coming. Now, the Egyptian army is much larger, and he believes, wrongly so, that he can conquer Antiochus. In the process, Antiochus defeats him, but doesn't kill him. He takes Ptolemy the VI captive and takes him back to the Syrian capital. He keeps him there and then occasionally brings him out and offers him various things. In the meantime, Ptolemy is replaced by his brother, Ptolemy the VII. Ptolemy the VII is now reigning in Egypt. Ptolemy the VI is in jail in Antioch under Syrian control. In the process, Antiochus says to Ptolemy the VI, "Tell you what, you want your kingdom back, you want to go home, I can make that happen. The only requirement is that when you go back, you have to help me destroy your brother. And then we're going to have complete control of all of this property and all of this land." Now, Ptolemy the VI knows that Antiochus is a liar. He knows it because he's one too. And so, birds of a feather, as it were. And what is described is the negotiation that takes place. In verse 22, it says that he will be swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. This is the covenant agreement between Antiochus and Ptolemy. And then in verse 23, "From the time that an alliance is made with him, he will act deceitfully and will become strong, even though his forces are actually smaller." How does he get strong? He gets strong through political intrigue. Verse 25, skip 24 for a second. Verse 25, "He will stir up his power And the king of the south with a great army, the king of the south will wage war with an exceeding great army, but he shall not stand because of the plots devised against him. It says that even those who eat his food shall break him. His army will be swept away, and many will fall down slain. As for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. So now they're together. They will speak lies at the same table. They negotiate at dinner, but they're lying to each other. But it is to no avail. Now, here's what I want you to see. The last phrase of that verse says, until the time appointed. Now, what Antiochus and Ptolemy the Sixth did was they made an agreement that they would go and they would conquer Egypt, and he would put him back in power, and then he would unseat his brother, and they would have this alliance. What Ptolemy the Sixth was thinking in his head was, I'm going to go along with this madman. I'm going to get back to Egypt, and there I'll marshal my forces, and then we'll run him out of town. But I'm going to tell him whatever he needs to hear in order to agree to this so that I can get out of here and get back home. So all the while, there's no truth in anything that anybody is saying. And so everything is a manipulation, and everything is a calculated strategy that is designed in the minds of men, given by the evil force of Satan himself, in order to control people and property. Again, what did I say at the very beginning? Satan is going to do everything he can to come at us in a way that makes it look attractive and to tell us that we are able to manage this on our own and that we don't need God. And we can use whatever resources or abilities that we have, and then we can treat the world around us not as a gift of God's grace, but we can treat it and the people in it as our own property. There's all kinds of sin going on here, from greed and hubris to pride and arrogance. I mean, all of these things are on full display. And the reason we look at it and feel a little bit uncomfortable and hinky about it is because it's kind of tweaking something inside of all of us, because we all have those tendencies. That is the very nature of sinfulness. So they agree to all of this, and they send him back. And he places Ptolemy the Sixth back in a position of power. Ptolemy the Seventh retreats. He's in Alexandria, which is the capital of Egypt at the time. And so then, after all this has happened, Antiochus has pretty much run roughshod over that whole north and south kingdom. He comes back. He has taken all of their money. And so along the way, he starts handing it out. And he gives payments to all of the people that can help him. What is this talking about? Well, it says in verse 24, he will scatter among them plunder, spoil, and goods, and devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time. He's not being Robin Hood. He's giving payouts to people in order to ensure their loyalty. And so, would you be willing to be loyal to someone evil if, in fact, it benefits you financially? Well, of course not. It's easy to say when nobody's offering you anything, isn't it? Well, think about it like this. It has been said that Americans, because of our unique system of democracy, oftentimes will vote with their pocketbooks above their ethics. Oh, now you've gone to meddling. I'm just saying you need to be very careful about what sort of condemnation we launch in the direction of someone else if we aren't willing to face it ourselves. I realize that we're living in a broken world with a very difficult system, but I want us to also be reminded that the causes of Christ are not accomplished by the evil machinations of man. They thought they were in control. But repeatedly throughout this prophecy, it says, but only for a time. Until the appointed time. Until the time is done. What is that reminding us of? It's reminding us that while he may think he's in charge, Antiochus is not in charge. So Ptolemy VI goes back to Egypt in the reign of Antiochus. Antiochus comes back. He delivers all of this money, gives all of this stuff. But then in verse 28, a very interesting phrase occurs. It says, but his heart shall be set against the Holy Covenant. The Holy Covenant is a reference to Israel and to the Jews. And Antiochus IV has hated the Jews since he came to power and before. He wants everything that has anything whatsoever to do with Judaism to be removed. He doesn't want them to have freedom to worship. He doesn't want them to be identified as a unique people. He does not want them to have access to the Word of God. He does not want them to rise in any sort of way because he sees that as a threat. And why is that? It's because he's being driven by pure evil, and evil and good are always going to be in conflict with one another, never comfortable with one another. When you get to the point where you are comfortable in the presence of evil, something is desperately wrong. Believers should always have a discomfort. Even if it's something you've decided to do and you know in your heart it's wrong, or someplace you've decided to go, or something you are currently engaged in, you know in your heart that it's wrong, please pray to God that that conviction of your sin will never be lifted, because it's the only thing protecting you. So we see in verses 29 through 35 the ruin of Antiochus. While all of this is going on, Ptolemy the 6th and 7th get back together. They are reunited as brothers against Antiochus, and they turn against him in a way that is going to probably make him very angry. So in verse 29, at the time appointed, he shall return and come into the south, but it shall not be this time as it was before. So once the Ptolemies get back together and unite against him, he goes down there to show them a thing or two. But it says that it will not be as it was before. What does this mean? Well, he gives us a brief description of that. It says that in verse 30, the ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw, and shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the Holy Covenant. So Antiochus is on his way to destroy Egypt. This time he's going to kill them all. They know that. And they know that they're not going to be able to stand against him. And so the Ptolemies send a message to Rome. And they say, look, if you want to have any hope of protecting the shipping and trade that comes through Egypt and North Africa, you need to help us out, because this crazy person is coming to kill us. Rome does want to protect that interest, and they have a very direct interest in North Africa, in particular Egypt. History has borne that out over time, and we have seen that down through the ages. It's a big deal. And so Rome dispatches a navy, a whole fleet of navy ships from the island of Cyprus. The word Cyprus, or the island of Cyprus, kind of became a common word in the ancient world for the Mediterranean. And so the Mediterranean Sea was oftentimes referred to as Cyprus, or ships from Cyprus. Here you see the word Kittim. Kittim is just an older word for Cyprus. And so they send the commander. The commander comes with a letter from the Roman emperor for Antiochus. He lands on the shore just north of Alexandria, where Antiochus' forces are arrayed and are ready to finish the battle. And he walks up to him, as history records, and it's recorded from a number of different sources, and he hands him the letter. Now, Antiochus is no stranger to Romans. Remember, he was a hostage there for nearly 20 years. So he's seen their power from the inside out. He hands the letter to him, and then he takes his sword and draws it out. And it may not have been that long. Mine is. And he walks around him and draws a circle in the sand. He says to Antiochus, read the letter, but I'll need your decision before you step outside the circle. Now, this is in-your-face intimidation that he has not seen before. This is the kind of behavior Antiochus has been exhibiting toward others. And now he is... He's not the biggest bully on the block anymore. Rome is, and Rome knows it. Antiochus has no choice. Reads the letter, he folds it up, he signs it, gives it back with a seal on it, promising to withdraw. And then the Romans disembark from their ships and stand between him and Egypt until he withdraws. And then they follow him back. Now, while all this is going on, a rumor has started back in Jerusalem that Antiochus has been killed in battle. And a revolt starts to take place, an uprising of the Jews against the Syrians. They see this as an opportunity to throw off the yoke of their oppression, and they start rising up against them. On the way back to his home territory, he hears about this uprising. He already hates the Jews, and so he attacks Jerusalem and Judea. That is also predicted in the prophecy. It says he shall be enraged and take action against the Holy Covenant in verse 30. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. So he is able to twist a lot of the Jews to forsake Judaism and to follow false teachings and to worship Zeus. And so now he is splitting them up. But the forces from him, it says in verse 31, shall appear, profane the temple and the fortress, take away the regular burnt offering, and set up the abomination that makes desolate. And so to drive home the point, he slaughters 80,000 men, women, and children in Judea. Just slaughters them. And then he puts up a temple or an altar to Zeus inside the temple to God. It says in verse 32, he will seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. So he seduces them to follow him, and he promises them wealth and prosperity and safety. But it says there are others who do not go along with this and who are true to their faith. So from this point onward, you can read about it historically, at least to some degree, from the books of the Maccabees. And so a man named Mattathias Maccabeus is a leader. He's a priest. He lives in a community just north of the city of Jerusalem, and he started the revolt. Mattathias refuses to go along with this blasphemy, and eventually during one of the raids, he is killed. But he has four sons. Three of them take over for him. Judas Maccabeus and the other two brothers, Jonathan and, I don't remember the other one. There's a third one. They take over for him. Judas will eventually be killed, but the brothers are simply referred to from that point forward as the Maccabees. And the Maccabean revolt takes place. Many people join them, and they continue to grow in power. And in spite of all of the horrors that have been committed against them, in 167 BC, they attack. And when they do, they are able to defeat Antiochus' forces, who have been depleted through their war with Egypt. They are driven out of Jerusalem, and on December the 14th, they rededicate the temple. December 14th is still celebrated by the Jews as the day of Hanukkah, and the word Hanukkah means dedication. And so the Maccabean revolt effectively drives them out. Judas is killed during the fighting, but the other brothers continue, and the people, numbers grow, and they join them and eventually reclaim all of Palestine. And Syria is driven to the north, and they are going to have complete control of all of Palestine for what will be almost 100 years before they fall under Roman authority again. During that time, they not only rededicate the temple, they also get rid of all of the half-hearted Jews. It's pretty stark. It says in, verse 32, he shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, And then it says, and the wise in verse 33, among the people shall make many understand, though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. When they stumble, they will receive a little help. This is where people join them after Mattathias and Judas are killed. Many shall join themselves to them with flattery, and some of the wise shall stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made white until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time. Essentially, what happens in Jerusalem is that faith is refined and purified, and all of this divisiveness and all of this false worship and all of these evil presence of false gods, all of that is purged. I'm not saying that that was a good thing necessarily. This is just what is predicted. I think it was necessary at some point in some fashion, but it was very violent. And so the nation of Israel is reconstituted, and the worship of God is reinstated, and a new vigorous focus on the Word of God now comes into play. This sets the stage for what is going to come. And so what you see in all of these historical events is the establishment of what will be 100 years of reign of self-rule before the Romans come to power, during which time the Hasidim, which we know of as the Essenes, who later preserved for us the Dead Sea Scrolls, they are a very devoted group of people that are committed to Jewish tradition and truth. The Pharisees and the Sadducees are divisions of that that will grow up during that time. And all of this brings together something that provides the perfect stage for Jesus. So that when you read in the Bible that the fullness of time would come and then he was born, this is preparation for the fullness of time. But notice that it comes through hardship and warfare and violence and death and pain and lies and evil and intrigue. What is it telling us? It's telling us that this is the way of life and that it's going to continue this way, and it is but a prelude of what is to come, and that the one who will come after him that will be like him will be far worse than him. It isn't given to scare you. It is given to stimulate your intelligence. You don't need to be afraid to know that judgment is coming. You don't need to be afraid to know that evil is going to be defeated and that God is going to reign and those who align themselves against him will be destroyed. You don't need to be afraid. You just need to be smart enough. And it doesn't take much. Quit holding on to yourself and the world around you and the junk that is in you. Understand that what God is calling you to is a relationship of faith with him. He has made it very clear how that should look. And he has told us beyond any measure of doubt what we are to do. He has told us that we are to seek him. In so doing, we commit our lives to Jesus, trusting that what he has done on the cross takes care of our sin and what he did alone, and believing that his righteousness is declared over us so that we now become disciples following him, living to his glory so that others will know that too. In the process, we experience his peace so that we have the peace that abides beyond all understanding, that sustains us as we live through this life of turmoil, knowing that it is brief, we are but visitors here, and then we're home. And when that happens, it's always good. It's going to be perfect. So what do we take away? Evil's still up to its old tricks. Satan's still going to use the same methodology. He's going to try to persuade you. He's going to come to you, and like the salesman, he's going to say, look, I'm here to work for you. Yeah, I'm paid by them, but I'm working for you. Isn't that interesting? He's not working for you. Working for himself. He's going to come to you, and he's going to be beautiful, attractive, popular. Everybody's going to be doing it. And you're going to have to go against it. He's going to come to you in a way that will seduce you away from truth or into a compromise of it. Either one works. Either way, you don't have truth anymore. He's going to tell you that the brokenness of this world is unfair and that you deserve better. The reality is you don't deserve better, and it's perfectly fair. It is the consequence of our sin. He's going to tell you that what God has said in His Word isn't true, and yet the Word is going to verify itself so that we would even have a prophecy hundreds of years before that is fulfilled in infinitesimal detail later. Don't forget these things. And what is the final takeaway? Judgment's coming, Jesus is coming. And when He does, we're going to be made whole. We don't need to fear. We don't need to live in fear. We don't need to wring our hands. All of the times are appointed. Let me read them to you and I'll quit. In verse 24 it says, "For only for a time." In verse 27 it says, "For the end is yet to be at the time appointed." At the time appointed, verse 29 says. Verse 35, "Until the time of the end, for it still awaits the appointed time." Who's making the appointment? Not you and not me. It's God. If God is in control of all these appointed times, and if He is the one who has decided when all of this is to take place, then how are we in our foolishness going to stand against that, nor why would we? But by His grace and love, He has extended Himself to us in Jesus Christ, and He says to us, "Trust me, I've got this." And so then it falls on us. Do you trust Him? And will you follow Him? I know that this looks terrible. This man in history was an awful person. But you'll want to come back next week because this is only a prelude of things to come.